And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The second case on our Zoom oral argument calendar today is A230515, State of Minnesota versus Nicholas Allen McCartney. For those of you who have joined us since we first started, this is obviously being broadcast on Zoom. There will be a recording, an audio recording available on our website later today or tomorrow. That is the only recording that is to be made of this proceeding. Counsel for the appellant, you have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 for rebuttal. And respondents counsel, you have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin, if you could just identify yourself and how you would like us to refer to you. And Mr. McLaughlin, whenever you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant Nicholas McCartney on this case. A person accused of a crime may waive his constitutional rights and plead guilty to the offense, but the Constitution requires that an accused's decision to plead guilty is made intelligently. An intelligent plea requires that the accused be informed accurately of the direct consequences of the conviction. Here, Mr. McCartney was not accurately informed of the direct consequences of the conviction. Specifically, he was misinformed about the mandatory minimum sentence. In addition, he was not informed at the plea hearing of the maximum sentence he faced.
Mr. McLaughlin, yep. Leaving the maximum sentence alone, you had your plea hearing on September 23rd. And at that time, McCartney stated that he understood the nature of the charge, that it's a presumptive 60-month sentence. He got a 60-month sentence. And then we go forward to the January 9 sentencing hearing, and McCartney's attorney says he doesn't dispute there's a presumptive 5-year sentence carried with the nature of the charge. So I'm at a loss at following that argument. The maximum sentence may be different, but why are you claiming that he didn't understand the consequences of his plea as it relates to the firearm?
I mean, the basis for the argument is that there's a difference between a presumptive sentence and a mandatory minimum sentence. If it's a presumptive sentence, the court has discretion to depart and order a probationary sentence. If it's a mandatory minimum sentence, such that, and specifically the kind that applied here, where under 6 and 9/11, the court does not have discretion to depart. That is different.
I'm going to interrupt again. Going back to September 23rd, he says he understood that he would be, and now I'm doing an air quote, facing that sentence, which was the 60 months. So it appears that he understood at that time that this was what he was facing.
In context of what was said at the plea hearing was he would be facing that sentence if the court disagreed with us at sentencing. So he would be facing 60 months if the court rejected the dispositional departure argument. But that's something different. That's essentially just explaining to him that it's a presumptive sentence. But that's something different than a mandatory minimum sentence. Mandatory minimum sentence gave the court no discretion to depart. It had to impose at least 60 months, and it could not legally consider any dispositional departure argument.
Just for my clarification, your argument is primarily the intelligence of the plea. Are you, and this is my question now, are you, just so I'm clear, you're not disputing that, or are you, that the factual basis was lacking?
No, we're just arguing the intelligence of the plea. And just, go ahead, Judge, did you have a question?
I did. I just wanted to ask you, the district court ultimately didn't reference the mandatory minimum in its sentencing reasons. It denied the departure motion on the merits, on an amenability determination. What effect, if any, should that have on our analysis? Is there some sort of harmlessness review that we should be considering, given that even if there had been some sort of, even if she had the statutory discretion to go below the mandatory minimum, she indicated she wouldn't have done it.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. It's important, I think, also that the state and its opposition papers to the dispositional departure made precisely the argument we're making now, that that the mandatory minimum applied and that Mr. McCartney was not eligible for departure on that basis. So, based on the argument the state had made, there's every reason to believe that if the court would have imposed a departure, the state would have appealed that decision to this court and argued, as it did in its memorandum in district court, that Mr. McCartney was ineligible for a departure. So, you know, it would have been an illegal sentence if the court would have imposed a departure in this case. And there's every reason to think that the state would have appealed that decision to this court and this court would have corrected it on appeal. So I don't believe the error is harmless for that reason.
And because it's not a sentencing error, really. It's plea error, right? It's as to the intelligence. So whether or not what sentence the court would have imposed has nothing to do with whether the plea was intelligent.
Right. And the problem is it was an illusory benefit that Mr. McCartney thought he was receiving. And that was instrumental to his decision to plead guilty. And that was based on he thought that he had a chance at probation, when in fact this mandatory minimum applied and he was misadvised by his attorney that it did not apply and that he would have the opportunity to argue for probation.
Go ahead, Judge Bjorkman.
I was just saying, as Mr. McCartney appeared for sentencing, he was aware, was he not, that the county was taking the position that this was a mandatory minimum sentence, correct? Because that was their response to the departure motion, I think you just told us. Am I correct?
It was in the state's response. So that had been filed. I would just also note, though, that it was not listed in the PSI. The mandatory minimum was not listed in the PSI. And then at the actual sentencing hearing, there was no reference from the district court or from his attorney or even from the state regarding that the mandatory minimum. But it was in a document filed by the state, yes.
So isn't there some significance to the fact that he, you know, the district court was clear at the plea hearing that it was not accepting the guilty pleas at that point. Coming into the sentencing hearing with knowledge that the county at least was taking the position that the district court had no discretion in departing dispositionally, is it significant that your client did not ask the court to reject the plea that had not yet been accepted?
I don't believe it precludes his claim that the plea was not intelligent. And his attorney who was representing him, his advisor, who you know, he was relying on for legal knowledge, was continuing to argue for a departure. And based on that argument, Mr. McCartney would have concluded that at least his attorney thought he was eligible for a departure and the mandatory minimum didn't apply. And then the way the court analyzed the case, the court, another authority figure that Mr. McCartney would have looked to for his understanding, the court handled things at sentencing like he was eligible for a departure and the mandatory minimum didn't apply. So, you know, based on the way his attorney handled it, based on the way the court handled it, Mr. McCartney wouldn't have had a basis to conclude that is, you know, that he'd been misadvised at the time of his plea.
I don't quarrel with you, Mr. McLaughlin. It wasn't a perfect plea hearing, but what weight, if any, can we attribute to the fact that early on in the proceedings, he received a common statement of rights form and the judge said, do you want me to go over your rights with you? And he made a reply that he was very familiar, not very is my word, that he was familiar with his rights. How much weight can we put to that, which preceded the plea that was presented?
You know, this court has in Doman and Wiley has looked to the broader record beyond the plea proceedings, you know, as relevant information for a defendant's understanding of his or her right to the plea. But here, what happened at the Rule 8 proceeding, what he said was he was aware of his rights, but there was no recitation of specific rights at the Rule 8 hearing and on the transcript.
He had been given a written advisory, right? I mean, as I read that transcript, it seemed like the district court was referring to a written statement or written advisory, which is not uncommon in my experience.
I know, I mean, there is a written advisory that that is typically given to defendants at the Rule 8 hearing. I mean, what the court said on the record was, you should also have been given a statement of rights form and the court should have gone over your rights with you at the last hearing. Do you understand your rights or would you like me to go over those again? And then McCartney replied, I'm familiar with my rights, Your Honor. There's no, beyond that, there's nothing at the Rule of 8 hearing that he was served at that proceeding with the statement of rights form. And I'm not aware that document is elsewhere in the record. And I don't believe the state relied on that in its argument or in its briefing. So from that statement, we don't know what he knew. I mean, he said at the Rule 8 hearing that he was aware of his rights, but we don't know what
what his understanding was based on that. And then
let me ask you one other question that's maybe a little off topic, but you reference it in various ways in your brief. And I'm wondering if you're contending that the remote nature of the plea hearing, I mean, the remote hearing format, and particularly with respect to your client and his lawyer not being in the same place, that that implicates the validity of his plea.
Our argument is not that that itself is a basis for the plea to be invalid, but it is a relevant circumstance on the issue of whether there's a presumption that the attorney adequately advised Mr. McCartney. And part of that presumption that this court has applied in the past is that has been based on that the attorney had full opportunity to talk to the defendant and go over the rights. And that's here, the fact that it was by Zoom, that reduced the opportunity of the attorney to advise Mr. McCartney in a way that he might have if they were together.
And, although you did say in response to the court's question at the plea hearing, have you had enough time to talk with Mr. Thompson both about the plea agreement and about your case? And he said, yes, Your Honor. Right. I mean, he indicated he's fully satisfied with his attorney's representation. So that's additional evidence in the record from which we could infer that he was aware of his rights and had discussed the terms of the plea agreement.
And I think that statement, again, doesn't resolve exactly if he knew what he was supposed to know, if he knew what those rights were. I mean, he did state that he felt comfortable with what his attorney had told him, but there's also a statement from the attorney that he normally would have gone over a written plea petition with a client, but in this case, because the plea came together that day of the Zoom hearing, he did not have the opportunity to review the petition with Mr. McCartney. So we know at least that there was no specific review of the written plea petition with the attorney and Mr. McCartney.
What about his acknowledgement of the receipt of the complaint, which on its face sets forth the statutory maximum, and his indication that he read the complaint? How do you reconcile that with your argument that it's error, that he wasn't specifically advised of the 15-year maximum?
I would just note that Rule 15 requires that the defendant be advised of the maximum at the time of the plea, and that, you know, that the court ensures that that advisory occurs, as well as the mandatory minimum. So Rule 15 hasn't found that a complaint is sufficient and is further required advisory at the time of the plea, because that is such a significant consequence for a defendant. So, I mean, that is a fact that this court could look at to support an inference that he was aware of the maximum, but Rule 15 suggests that it being in the complaint is not sufficient by itself.
But it seems like your strongest argument is about the mandatory minimum, yes, right? Because yes. Nobody yes. knew that the mandatory minimum no, applied. And even the state actually argued against the departure on the merits after saying that it was a mandatory minimum case. And then the state added nothing at the sentencing hearing to its brief, didn't mention the mandatory minimum again. And so, you know, there was nothing from the sentencing hearing to indicate to your client that he was subject to a mandatory minimum at that point in time to say, hey, wait a minute, I want to withdraw my plea, right?
Right. That's correct. And the complaint also did not reference the mandatory minimum. And, you know, we're talking about the mandatory minimum versus the maximum. I mean, the maximum wasn't going to change his decision making either way, realistically, but the mandatory minimum would have. I mean, if he knew he didn't have a shot at a departure and he was guaranteed 60 months, he would have been much more likely to go to trial and take his chances, because that was the only way that he was going to avoid that consequence, and also the only way that he could preserve the pretrial issues that he litigated. So, you know, the mandatory minimum mattered, and he was affirmatively misadvised on that key consequence. And nothing happened at sentencing that would have alerted him to, you know, to the fact that both the attorney and the court had really misadvised him regarding that mandatory minimum. And I think to kind of draw a little bit of a comparison to the, you know, immigration context with deportation, it's well established that advising a client that deportation is possible is deficient and is inaccurate advice when the person faces mandatory deportation. And I think the attorney's advice here is very similar. You know, he advised him that there's a presumptive 60-month that it was a possibility, but that's something different than a mandatory minimum. That's something different than being guaranteed that you're facing a certain consequence. So based on that and all the other deficiencies in these proceedings, and you know, I think what was just a mistake and an error that the plea petition was never reviewed and filed, you know, all those things combined together, we'd ask the court to find that the plea in this case was unintelligent and give Mr. McCartney a chance to withdraw it and have a trial if he chooses to.
Thank you, counsel. And any other questions from the? All right. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tyler Kenevick. I'm an assistant St. Louis County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. The matter ultimately comes to whether the defendant entered an intelligent plea. As counsel indicated, there's a number of issues, including the mandatory minimum, as well as whether he was aware of his trial rights. I would note, as the court mentioned, that there was a statement of rights form, and it was, in fact, in the record. That statement of right form specifically stated, I understand that, in number two, the maximum sentence of each offense is specified in the complaint. And additionally, number seven, I have a right to a trial before a judge if the offense is a petty misdemeanor, trial for a jury, a judge without a jury, if the offense is a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, to remain silent at all times, including trial. Anything I say may be used against me. The right to confront, cross-examine all witnesses, and the right to...
But that list doesn't contain anything about the statutory maximum or mandatory minimum, right? I mean, boilerplate list.
Correct. It does state the maximum sentence for each offense is specified in the complaint. And also note that the transcript in the Rule 8 hearing indicates that the defendant specifically read the complaint, which would include the statutory maximum.
But not the mandatory minimum.
It does not encompass the mandatory minimum, no, Your Honor.
But we've never said a Rule 8 is enough as far as the waiver of rights on record. It's a factor we can draw, but you're not asserting that at the Rule 8 hearing, which is very typically without an attorney, that that's enough. That's not your position, is it?
No, that's not my position, Your Honor. But I think the important thing is, and it's addressed in Hernandez v. State, is that just because in the rule itself, that just because every specific trial right is not addressed on record at the plea hearing does not invalidate the plea in and of itself. So the question becomes then, what other indications would indicate that this is not constitutionally intelligent? And you look at also his criminal history, but his admission that, or his statement at the Rule 8 that he understood his rights, both from the statement of rights and his prior convictions, which he has, I believe, four felonies, which he would have gone through this process. And
I wanted to ask you about that because you included some of the plea petitions from other files in the addendum. Are any of those plea petitions that you submitted part of the record in this case?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. As far as the addendum, I suppose it would be in the record. I do apologize. I'm arguing, but I did not submit the brief, so I'm still catching up. But I do believe that...
Well, the prior convictions are in the PSI, but not necessarily the Rule 15.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So we don't have an objection as far as extra record evidence. So right now, we don't know if it's in or out.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I would note also that he's at the plea hearing specifically. The court asked, as the court mentioned here, that the court asked the defendant if he had had enough time to speak with his attorney. And even prior to that, the defendant indicated he had been given 30 minutes in a breakout room to discuss the matter beforehand.
Do you agree that everybody at the time of the plea, the state, the defense, and the court all seemed to be laboring under the assumption that a departure was possible at the time of the plea? Do you agree with that?
I do not believe the state was laboring under that assumption.
The reason I ask that is that the document filed in opposition to the defendant's motion for a dispositional departure by the state says, in exchange for the defendant's plea of guilty, the state agreed that defendant could argue for a departure. So it appeared to me that at the time of the plea, even the state, the first time that the mandatory minimum comes up that I can see in the record is in the state's opposition to the motion for dispositional departure, which was filed after invitation from the court so the court could consider the matter further. And so I'm just wondering if you are aware of anything in the record that would have indicated that anyone knew at the time of the plea that this was a mandatory minimum case.
Your Honor, I don't know if there's anything specifically in the record indicating that it would be a mandatory, as you say, mandatory minimum. I do note that at the plea hearing itself, both counsel agreed that there was no agreement as to the sentence, that it was going to be a plea and that the sentence would be argued.
Right, but that's generally understood to be a guidelines type of agreement, not... It doesn't matter if anyone had an agreement as to the mandatory minimum, because that's set by the legislature and the court has to follow it, right? I mean, it's...
Correct. But my statement is that you indicated that the argument, or there could be an argument for a dispositional departure. But if there's no, at least on the record, it says that there was no agreement between the parties as to sentencing.
Well, let me just confirm. Do you agree that this was a mandatory minimum case? That's what I didn't really see you or see that addressed in the state's brief. And that seems very important to me, because I don't know how this can be an intelligent plea if a mandatory minimum applied and no one knew about it at the time of the plea.
Your Honor, I would actually just point to State v. Trott, which kind of dealt with a very similar situation where the individuals did not know about the mandatory minimum at the time of plea. And then it became an issue at sentencing. Specifically, it's 338 Northwest 2D248. And actually, there's a pretty good sentence right here. It says, neither defendant nor his counsel at the time made any motion. After discussion before the court in which counsel participated, neither defendant nor counsel at the time made any motion to continue the sentencing or withdraw his plea for the mistake. In that case, the defense was under the assumption that it would be a 21-month sentence. And so specifically, State v. Trott stated that even where there's not a knowledge that the presumptive minimum comes into play, once the other party is put on notice prior to the sentencing, the proper remedy would be to ask for a continuance of the sentence or withdraw his plea at that time. I don't think it could be argued that the defendant didn't know about the plea or didn't know about the state's position as far as the briefing goes, as the defense was served with the state's memorandum as far as sentencing. So if under State v. Trott, it seems pretty clear that at the plea is not required that the mandatory minimum needs to be applied. There might be a question whether it would be intelligent, but the proper time to make that determination would be prior to sentencing.
Right, but isn't the problem with Trott that the trial court actually had the discretion to depart from the mandatory minimum?
I don't think that was the focus of Trott. I think Trott was very specific that the question is, there was a mistake at the time of the plea. Defense had the opportunity to withdraw his plea or request to withdraw it or ask for a continuance to do further research. And at that time, the defendant didn't do that. And so the court said, that would have been the proper time. And since they didn't do it, there is no basis to say it was an unintelligent plea.
Well, it ends this, the second to last paragraph of the opinion is defendant claims that the trial court was not aware that on its own motion, it could sentence defendant without regard to the mandatory minimum term of law. But then the trial court specifically stated that it could not find any substantial reasons for departing. This suggests to me that this wasn't a mandatory minimum case, and that's the difference.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think that's a separate section than from 3. The section that dealt with whether he could withdraw his plea was section 3. Section 4 dealt with a separate thing where the judge was unaware whether he could depart from the mandatory minimum and whether that caused a separate reason to have a withdrawal of the plea.
So is it your position then that because after the December 22, sentencing hearing was continued so that you could submit your written statements about sentencing, and when you came back in January, that somehow the appellant forfeited or waived any challenge to the intelligence of his plea by failing to seek plea withdrawal at that point upon seeing the state's argument about this being a mandatory minimum sentence?
I don't know if I'd go so far as forfeiture, but I think it goes to whether it's an intelligent plea, because the defense had the opportunity to review the state's submissions and see the position of the state that the mandatory minimum was in fact a mandatory minimum. And its decision not to withdraw the plea or seek a continuance would indicate that was either aware and decided to go forward anyways. Maybe it's true that the plea itself, that no one knew that it was a mandatory minimum. But once the state filed that response to this summary, everyone should have been aware. I don't know. Now, at the sentencing, it does appear that they went ahead and did the dispositional departure. But frankly, that could have been because the judge believed that it wasn't a mandatory minimum. But ultimately, it didn't reach that decision because they found that there was no substantial compelling reasons to depart anyways. And I think that's really the key thing, is that State v. Trott says that the consequences of the the placement on either the presumptive sentence or the application of a mandatory minimum does not need to be discussed on the record at the time of plea in order for a plea to be constitutional. The question then becomes whether it was known at the time of sentencing. And maybe there needs to be a further factual record in a post-conviction relief, but I don't think we can make the assumption that the defendant wasn't aware of the state's position because he wasn't given that brief or wasn't let known by the defense attorney.
I'm still not seeing in Trott what you're citing for the support as to a mandatory minimum, because the sentence I see is, we are unwilling to hold that a defendant must be questioned by the trial court at the time he enters his guilty plea to ensure that he understands what the presumptive sentence is under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. I mean, that seems to be the big difference here, is that we have it's not a guidelines issue. If it would be a much easier case for the state if it was advisement of the guidelines. But this is, as Mr. McLaughlin said, that any promise that was indicated in the state's opposition brief that was made that he could ask for a dispositional departure was illusory because it was a mandatory minimum case. And so how can we find that this was an intelligent plea under those circumstances?
Your Honor, because the defendant was made aware by the state's memorandum that this was in fact a it's the state's position that it was a mandatory consecutive sentence before sentencing.
Forfeiture is the biggest response the state has, is because he didn't move to withdraw the plea.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I think that if you look at Trott, actually the facts are somewhat worse because the court itself didn't know that it could depart. So in the district court's mind, it was in fact a mandatory minimum. So if even with that wasn't enough to reverse that case, I don't see how this case, where the court actually did take under advisement the question or the argument that he was substantial compelling reasons to depart, was a basis for a departure from the mandatory minimum. Even if it is it would be an illegal sentence, is still a question. And there's still a question of whether the court accepted that the state met its burden in showing that it would have been a proper mandatory minimum. The state feels like it had, but the court hadn't necessarily accepted it. So that hadn't been a disposition on whether it was in fact a mandatory minimum. I believe I've covered all the points that I intended to. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, but otherwise I would forfeit the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. McLaughlin.
Thank you, Jersey. Just to begin, I agree with your analysis of trial, Jersey, that it was not a mandatory minimum. The court still had discretion under the provision at issue in Trott to not impose that minimum and to still and to deviate from it. So it's categorically different than the type of mandatory that was at issue in this case. And when the Supreme Court's talked about direct consequences that a defendant must be aware of before a plea to be intelligent, Kaiser talked about the sentencing range, the range of punishment. A true mandatory is necessarily a range of punishment in a way that the provision in Trout was not. So I think distinguishable.
What about the forfeiture argument, Mr. McLaughlin, that Mr. Kenefick makes?
Again, the problem with that argument is that everything that occurred at sentencing would have led Mr. McCartney to conclude that
that the mandatory minimum did not apply and that a departure was still available. The way that his attorney approached the argument at sentencing, the way the court approached it, that all would have led him to conclude that that the mandatory minimum did not apply. So although there was something filed by the state, the two people that Mr. McCartney would have been relying on most directly at sentencing would have been his attorney and the court. And both those people told him that there was no mandatory minimum and that he could receive probation. So they argue that there's no forfeiture based on looking at the whole record. And that's another significant difference with Trott. I mean, at Trott, there was at least discussion of the mandatory minimum on the record at sentencing. That defendant was made aware of what happened at the sentencing proceeding, that there was this provision in place. Here, there was no discussion on the record at sentencing. In addition, Trott comes before Rule 15 was enacted. So now with Rule 15, there's a specific provision requiring the mandatory minimum as part of the advisory that did not exist at the time of Trott. So there are several reasons why Trott should not control.
Is an unintelligent plea structural error in your view? That can it be waived? Can it be forfeited?
No, it can't. And the way this court has addressed intelligence and other and you know, accuracy and voluntariness, those are all issues that a defendant can raise after sentencing, even if it was never argued at the time of the plea or at sentencing. It's like issues the defendant can raise at any time. So the forfeiture analysis has never been applied in this context. It's always a question of looking at the record that existed, you know, at the time of the plea and sentencing and determine whether the plea was intelligent based on that.
You bring up the question of the record. And that's my concern. Do we have enough of a record here to say that he didn't understand there was a mandatory minimum? I mean, this isn't a post-conviction appeal, so we don't have a developed record.
The way that Boykin and Cesarez have approached intelligence is it's the record must affirmatively show the plea is intelligent. So to the extent that the record is deficient to show intelligence, this court under Boykin and Cesarez has to find that the plea was unintelligent. I mean, in Boykin rested on the premise that an intelligent plea cannot be inferred from a silent record. So this record has to affirmatively show it. And here that just didn't happen. So a post-conviction is not the appropriate remedy. The appropriate remedy is for this court just to reverse the conviction outright.
What about the last argument Mr. Kenefick made that the court hadn't actually determined that it was a mandatory minimum yet, and that it seemed to me the state was suggesting some sort of uncertainty there. What's your response?
Our response would be that it's conclusively the mandatory minimum provision applies, and that's conclusive just based on the fact of the second degree assault conviction by itself. So the mandatory applies if a defendant is convicted of an offense that's listed under subdivision 9, and if the offense involved the possession or use of a dangerous weapon. The assault 2 provision that he was convicted under as elements requires the defendant to use a dangerous weapon to cause bodily harm or create a fear of bodily harm. So as the elements of that conviction, he necessarily would have met the requirements under the mandatory minimum provision. And then just looking at the facts of that secondary assault that the state referenced in its brief, that he used a motor vehicle he drove a motor vehicle into a romantic partner. This court has specifically held that a motor vehicle is a dangerous weapon when it's used in a manner as a dangerous weapon. I have the side of the case, it's not in my brief, but the court has held that specifically that this qualifies. Oh, it's State versus Abdus Salam 988 and W2D 493. So that specifically held that vehicle is a dangerous weapon when it's used as such. So that was the basis for a secondary assault conviction. That conviction alone would have made him expose him to that mandatory minimum provision.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you both, counsel. The matter is deemed submitted. We'll issue a decision in the statutory 90-day timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honors.